Studies by the Congressional Budget Office and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation have linked the rise in consumer bankruptcies directly to increased consumer debt. Since 1997, credit card issuers have nearly doubled the amount of credit they offer to consumers to more than $3 trillion, or about $30,000 per household. According to The Card Game, a new Frontline documentary by Lowell Bergman, consumers use plastic for 100,000 transactions a minute. And those transactions have resulted in billions in profits for banks and pain for many American consumers. Here to explain it all is Lowell Bergman. His documentary on the crisis will air tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on PBS, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
Today, there was an article on the Associated Press that for the first time in a decade, more people paid their credit card bills on time in the third quarter of this year than in the second quarter. Do you see that as a hopeful sign?
Well, it's part of what's been going on in the business in general. They've been getting rid of people who don't pay on time, which is a reverse in terms of their normal business strategy. And people have become much more conservative because there's much less money around, and I think there's a lot more realization that the economy isn't going to come back to where it was before, that we aren't going to do business the same way going forward.
Well, the same report culled from 27 million anonymous bank records suggested that the delinquency rate is falling on Visa and MasterCard accounts. But you said this is a reversal of the way they were doing business in the past. They were encouraging people who had a bad who didn't have much of a chance to pay off their debts to get credit cards?
Well, in the first day, if we take the last 30 years as the sort of era of the modern credit card, when the cap on all interest rates came off and the industry began to expand, within 10 years, that is 20 years ago, it was a saturated market where fees for cards were standard, about $60 a year, sometimes less, and interest rates around 18 or 19%. It was at that point that various innovators got into the business, one of whom was Providian Financial, who we profile in the first third of the documentary, and they began to offer things like cards with no annual fee, come-ons like 0%, focused on the market of people who normally didn't qualify for a credit card. And that could have been all kinds of different people, foreign nationals in the United States, people who didn't have a credit history, to the poorer or what we would call subprime market. And they expanded and made lots of money, and that model was adopted by the major credit card companies around the United States, which now really 80% of the market is six major banks. And so you had that idea. The ideal was a customer who paid off their loan over time in perpetuity would be the best way to do it for them from a kind of profit point of view, occasionally would miss a payment so they get a late fee, and they became the incredible profitable side of the business, the 10% of the customers who subsidized the other 90%.
In the documentary go ahead.
Well, those people are no longer the prime candidates that the credit card industry is looking for because their default rate is so high. Those are the people who are more likely to be unemployed. Those are the people who are now going into bankruptcy. Those are the people who are now costing them so much money that major banks like Bank of America will post losses in the credit card business this year.
But you also profile somebody who was pushed into default, a woman named Elizabeth Blas Cruz, who took out a credit card with a $500 limit, and she owed $480 when she suddenly went into default.
Well, because she got a late fee that pushed her over her limit, which got her an over-the-limit fee. And she was in dire economic situation at that moment. That's why she took the card. And that got her deeper into debt, and to the point where she eventually owed $3,000 on a $480 balance. That's not an unusual happening in the history of credit cards, particularly over the last decade. It's still happening to many people as they go into deeper financial problems individually. And unemployment is usually the way you can track that. The more people who are unemployed, the real unemployment rate apparently now is 70% or higher in terms of part-time as well as full-time unemployed. And because of that, the credit card business is shrinking. People are paying their debts off. The amount of outstanding debt in credit cards is decreasing. And while that decreases, the use of debit cards has increased. And the fee income that the banks have been making from debit cards has been expanding, actually exploding, and is now in the tens of billions of dollars.
Well, I want to get to debit cards in a little bit, but I was thinking about that Associated Press report, which also stated that credit card delinquencies were highest in Nevada at 1.98%, Florida 1.47%, Arizona 1.35%, and California 1.33%. Those are the states that were hardest hit by the housing crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
Well, you can't do what you could do in the past, which was take the equity in your ever-expanding sort of magical house, the home value, and use that equity to refinance your credit card debt at a lower rate and then go back out and use your card. That cycle, which had been around for a while but really became kind of an epidemic about 4 or 5 years ago, and with massive marketing campaigns by the credit card companies, can't happen anymore. So that puts an automatic cap on how much debt you can ring up on credit cards nationally, and may force the country in many ways into a change in the way it does business and the way people live.
How has the rapid decline in housing values impacted those families who refinance to pay off credit card debt?
Well, they can't do it anymore, and those mortgage problems and related employment problems and the inflation of their debt due to credit cards all combined together push many people towards bankruptcy. Now, the industry really hates bankruptcy because, unlike a foreclosure on a home or on a car loan, there's no collateral. And they don't get that money back. And that's why this is one of the best times to call your credit card company and try to renegotiate your situation, because they don't want you to stop paying now. They need you.
So the credit card companies were encouraging us to not pay off the complete debt in the past, and they made a lot of money, but now they're paying the price for those policies?
Yeah, after 30 years of educating the public to live, in a sense, beyond its means, now the chicken has come home to roost, and they're caught in a situation where they have large numbers of customers, many with balances, who really can't afford to pay, not at the rates that are going on and not with the automatic sort of fee violations that have gone on in the past. So as much as the new regulations that are coming into effect and will come into effect in February, it's the objective conditions in the economy itself that are changing the way in which the business is done with individual consumers.
Well, I'm no longer receiving at least one or two solicitations a day offering me 0% credit if I switch over to a credit card, a new credit card company. I imagine that's a direct result of this change.
Yeah, the mailings, which were the number always escapes me because it's in the billions of pieces, but the mailings are way down. There's a large percentage decrease in the direct solicitation mail. What they're looking for now, what they're culling their accounts for, are people who can pay and will pay. They still like what they call revolvers. They don't like deadbeats, people who pay off at the end of the month. They're looking for people who carry a balance, but they're looking for people who carry a balance who are employed and are likely to keep paying. That's the primary candidate now. It's no longer someone who they can get the most fees out of, the most penalty interest out of up front, and then possibly eventually they may become, in a sense, more responsible customers, but those were the real profit center, particularly for those banks that were in the subprime lending area.
So let's back up a bit. They would encourage people who might be risks or for one reason or another might not be the ideal candidate to get a credit card or two, and they would offer them no fee. And
large balance, you'd feel good because you got a $10,000 credit line or a $20,000 credit line.
So how did they make their money? This is Providian started this, you say, in the show.
Well, Providian was very focused in the way it did it. It actually also picked out by zip code areas where they would flood credit card solicitations. But Providian did things like charge interest on the date of purchase as opposed to giving you a 30-day grace period. Provision, you know, they would give you a credit card, give you a line of credit, but start making money the first day that you made the purchase.
Can they just set those kinds of rules?
They could do anything they wanted as long as it was in their agreement and you signed it.
But it's hard to understand those agreements. In fact, the man behind Providian, the former CEO, Shailesh Mehta, pretty much suggests that you'd have to have a degree in law to understand what they're telling you in the on those all of that those agreement papers.
Well, the major, especially the innovators in the credit card business and the consumer lending business, always depended upon a lack of full understanding on the part of the consumer. First, if you're starting off with the idea, and I think you're old enough to remember possibly when they actually did have some consumer finance, home economics taught in secondary school in the United States, and you could balance a checkbook. That kind of education doesn't go on any longer in most schools in the United States. In fact, we couldn't fit it in the film, but if you go to the PBS website, pbs.org/frontline, you'll see a video tomorrow that will be on the Lehrer News Hour that's about what goes on in the military. The military, for its own reasons, that is, security clearances require a good credit rating because you might be vulnerable, has instituted massive financial education programs that are mandatory for people coming into the services because of the huge problem they had. We, the general population, don't get that kind of education. So that's what the industry was depending on. Now, if you go to the Daily Paper, it's been in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, around the country, there are these full-page ads, for example, from Bank of America, where they are now talking about how they're the consumer-friendly bank. Everything's going to be simple. There aren't going to be as many tricks, but there aren't going to be as many products available to as many people.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll find out how those interest rates fluctuated so wildly and how you, even if you were paying off your bills and everything seemed to be perfectly fine, you still could see a rise in your interest rates, as we continue this conversation with Lowell Bergman, whose latest PBS documentary for Frontline is called The Card Game. It airs tomorrow night at 9 p.m. I'm talking with Lowell Bergman about his latest documentary for PBS Frontline series called The Card Game, which airs tomorrow night at 9 p.m. here in the New York metropolitan area. You were talking with the CEO, the former CEO of Providian, you looked at an offer for 0% APR, but the footnotes were on a separate piece of paper. And he pointed out that it was impossible to know when you were transferring your balance which interest rate you actually were going to qualify for.
And that's the way they did business. I should point out, by the way, that this is a joint reporting project with the New York Times, similar to the project we did 5 years ago on the same subject called The Secret History of the Credit Card. And in that film, as well as to a certain extent in this one, we unpack how the business worked and why it is you have no limit on interest rates, no limit on fees, and why it is that the credit card agreements that you would get in the mail read the way they did, or let's say were exercises in reading comprehension, which came down to one fact and one fact only. They could change the terms, and this is until the passage of this recent act signed by President Obama on Memorial Day weekend, that will make it more difficult for them to change the terms of the agreement. And there are certain practices that they once could do that they can't do any longer.
Well, one of them illustrate is involves a man who was barely keeping up with his monthly bills, and then he got a tonsil cancer and fell behind in his bills. The credit card company raised his interest rates from 8% to 19%, even though he hadn't been late on their bill, but had been late on an unrelated one.
And that's called universal default, which becomes illegal on February 10th, 2010, which allowed the company to immediately and arbitrarily change your interest rate if, in fact, you, for some reason, changed your either credit score or your payment history. And they could do that, and there was not much you could do about it other than pay off your bill and your outstanding balance in full and go somewhere else. And generally speaking, people who start to get into financial trouble can't go anywhere else. The new law requires that your in arrears on the account for 60 days before they can change anything. But as one consumer advocate, Martin Eakes of the Center for Responsible Lending, points out, it's not going to help in the end that many people who are already in severe economic trouble, particularly, let's say, the unemployed, because, in fact, you're going to be late 30 days, you'll be late 60.
Right.
And so the bill has a lot of loopholes in it, and it's not yet clear how Congress will try to plug those.
Isn't one of the loopholes that it was signed on Memorial Day but doesn't really go into effect until February 10, 2010?
It was originally a set of Federal Reserve regulations that weren't as strong, that weren't going to go into effect until July of next year, and then June or July, and then Congress did compromise and move it up to February, although Senator Dodd and others who were behind the legislation wanted it to go into effect immediately.
And the reason that it didn't is because the credit cards, the banks needed this time to figure out how they were going to proceed, and in some cases you suggest jack up rates right now so that they can get ahead of be ahead of the game before February 10th.
Well, they've done some critical things, not just jack up rates, but they've done some critical things to get prepared for that time so they can preserve some of their profitability as they see it. And one of them is, for example, instituting arbitrarily into your account that you're now on a variable rate. And that variable rate may be as much as 14% above the cost of funds to them. The irony, one of the mysteries of the credit card business is that while interest rates are an all-time low because the cost of funds to a lender from the Federal Reserve are at an all-time low, and you see that in your mortgage rates now down around 4.5-5%, it's not true in the credit card industry, where all the independent surveys have shown that interest rates have been raised on people either through instituting variable rates or just arbitrary changes in a wholesale way through the whole calendar year, starting actually earlier in the year and then going on much more intensely once it looked like the legislation was going to pass.
Well, the suggestion is that the lobbying effort by the banks was so powerful that nobody thought it was really going to pass. When you asked Senator Richard Shelby, the ranking Republican on the Banking Committee, why hasn't there been credit card legislation to control some of these abusive practices? Why did it take a near depression to do this? He replied, obviously, it's the lobbying power. And you report that
$30 million in the last campaign cycle to the
members alone
of the Senate Banking Committee.
He got $850,000 from the banking lobby. President Obama got $3.5 million. John McCain, $2.6 million. Chuck Schumer, $1.1 million. He's one of the advocates for change. Chris Dodd, $1.3 million. And then everybody else seemed to get a lot of money as well.
Yeah, and it raises the question, what is their influence? Right now, the amount of public anger focused on banks in general, credit cards and other instruments in particular, through polling and otherwise, having spent quite a bit of time in Washington over the last 6 months, it's very clear that the members of Congress have gotten the message. The interesting thing about credit cards and debit cards, when you're reporting on this, is the endless number of anecdotes that you get from members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, about problems that they themselves or their family had. I remember going into the FBI one day, where I've done a lot of stories, and mentioning to some of the people there that I was talking with about completely unrelated subjects, what am I doing, credit cards. They started introducing me to secretaries, to assistants, to agents, all of whom had problems with their credit cards or debit cards. So it's a kind of a universal plague out there that's finally catching up with the industry. Their customer base, I think, has made it pretty clear to Congress, Republicans and Democrats, they want action, they want change.
Well, we've been talking about the excesses regarding credit cards, and you keep on moving us on to debit cards. I always thought that debit cards were the safe way to go about things because you have the money in the bank and they just simply deduct some of it from your account.
Well, like the origins of the modern credit card with its unlimited interest rate, it was an unintended consequence that that stayed around, that that situation, which was a peculiar situation 30 years ago with very high inflation, stayed around to the present. Similarly, when what you now what we now call debit cards and overdraft fees were first introduced and suggested 20 years ago, it was a way for the banks to make some money on what they instituted called free checking. And those fees would help them subsidize that free checking, and those fees at the same time would save people who bounced a check that was called check overdraft protection. Would save them from, say, public embarrassment of having your check bounce, fees from a merchant, as well as a bank fee. The result of that is it became very, very popular. But once you stuck debit cards into that system, people started going over and, in a sense, having insufficient funds on very small transactions, especially when debit cards began to be able to be used as a form of electronic payment for services. So there you have the situation, which I'm sure many of your listeners have gone through, of getting a $3 cup of coffee that winds up costing you $33. That's become a major profit center for the, especially for most of the banks in the United States, and the big banks in particular. It's become so controversial that some of them are voluntarily changing their policies now.
Has it been addressed in the new legislation?
No.
And then we have also payday lenders who lend out $40 billion a year to get the maximum of a $255 advance on a paycheck costs $45 in fees, which is what, almost 461% for a two-week loan. That's usury, isn't it?
Well, that's a whole national discussion that hasn't happened in a long time. The word usury, which is something that people have been familiar with since the Bible and the Quran were written, Old and New Testaments, by the way. The idea that it's both morally, if not just sociologically, impossible to get people to pay very high levels of interest and have a healthy society. We had those limits in place in the United States until 1978, and again, I'll have to refer you to the other film, The Secret History of the Credit Card, which is streamed online at the Frontline website, which explains what went on 30 years ago to change that, to take the cap off. So there is no limit right now, federally, except when it's a member of the military, on what the interest rate is that can be charged. With payday lenders, and payday lenders are usually regulated still by the states. So 15 states have made it impossible through regulations or outright illegal for a payday lender to operate. The military has gotten Congress to basically put payday lenders and auto title lenders and similar kinds of non-bank lenders out of business, basically, when it comes to service personnel and their families. But in the rest of the states, they're very active. And it is one of the interesting things that I think we discovered doing the film, that the concept of free checking and debit card fees was, in a sense, promoted to the banks and sold to thousands of banks around the United States as a way to compete with payday lenders. It's a short-term vehicle. But it's a short-term vehicle for someone who would go in and do that, go to a corner store to get one of these loans, and you can see how it's done if you haven't done it by watching the documentary. It normally, in all too many cases, gets people into a cycle where they never get out of debt. And that's the reason you have usury laws, is to make sure people don't get into that situation where they're always paying what we used to call the loan shark.
Now, the new legislation doesn't put caps on the levels of interest rates, does it? Martin Eek says that the credit card interest rates can still range from 9 to 29%. 29% is, by most people's standards, usurious.
Look, we've seen interest rates with some individuals that go over 40% when we've talked to them. These are usually people who are considered to be high risk, recent immigrants, people without a real credit history. And the question is whether that makes sense at all. In the military, for example, they offer people, service personnel, a 0% loan for up to $500 to bridge a situation where they maybe fall behind on their payments. And it seems that the only way you can answer the question of how do you deal with people who are in dire financial situation or low income, they need particular help in order to get out of that situation. You can't just charge them whatever the market will bear. But the bills that are currently pending don't really address that in terms of interest rates. They change some of the conditions around how the rates can be charged. There is something in the pending Consumer Financial Protection Agency legislation that's currently in the Senate Banking Committee is discussing and will vote on. The House has already voted on it, and it's out of committee. That talks about reasonableness in terms of the fees that maybe should be charged. But no one's really talking about capping interest rates.
So does this mean we've learned nothing from this crisis?
It means that we've gone one step towards taking a closer look at what consumer lending possibly should be in a fair market as opposed to a free market. But we haven't gotten there yet.
You end on a very sad note about credit cards and humanity with Shailesh Mehta, the former CEO of Providian, saying that bankers will comply with any new legislation, but they'll try to outsmart it, and you say they'll find the loophole. That is really sad. But they will find the loophole, won't they?
Well, it's the nature of the marketplace, particularly when we're talking about short-term profitability, to look for the legal ways to make as much money as possible. And unless we set down markers about not just what's legal, but what is acceptable, I think we won't get too far away from the current practices. Some ways will be found. For instance, as more people are denied credit cards, they'll be, if they're still working, or if you haven't, by the way, you're on unemployment, you can get a payday loan too. They'll be going to these, quote, non-traditional lenders. And the question is, do we want them to operate in that way? There is a viable alternative, which not in all cases is the best of places to go, but in many more than in the commercial marketplace, and that's credit unions. And you can go to our website at pbs.org/frontline to the documentary's website, The Card Game, and get some guidance to credit unions, which generally speaking are much more humane. I'll give you the example. We talked with a North Carolina State Employees Credit Union. They have something very similar to a payday loan for people who are members who are in dire straits, and they charge 1% a month, as opposed to 460% every 2 weeks. And they say it's very profitable for them. But credit unions don't advertise. Credit unions don't have branches in different states. But credit unions operate under an 18% interest rate cap ever since Franklin Roosevelt's administration. And they seem to stay in business doing it.
So if they can make it work, why can't the other banks make it work? Why do they spend so much money to prevent those sorts of similar caps being put into place as an industry standard?
Well, they say everything from this would cap, such caps like 18% just they won't even consider, but even a 36% cap in the discussions that we had in Washington. Primarily what they say is it would end innovation. They couldn't afford their expenses. They're a profit-making company. These are nonprofits. And what by expenses, when you drill down on that, you're talking about advertising, promotion, and executive salaries.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately, on that sad note. But my great thanks to Lowell Bergman, whose latest documentary made with the New York Times for Frontline is called The Card Game. And it will air tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on PBS stations in the area. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, we will examine Wall Street's love affair with risk and what can be done to keep it from happening again. And then director Richard Linklater on his latest film, Me and Orson Welles, plus actor Viggo Mortensen discusses the challenges of starring in the new film adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Plus, many people are abandoning the small towns they grew up in. What impact is that having on the rest of America? The Leaded Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Alice Castle, Stephanie Bernhardt, Barbara Kahn, and Angela Sheldon. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leaded Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.